So I think we've waited the requisite 5 minutes for the stragglers to come in. Yeah. It's already established, I think. All right. So I know that all of us here, maybe not myself included, but at least everybody in the audience, is a high-minded theorist who likes to solve problems from first principles and find the exact answer and, you know, get Nobel Prizes and things like this. But today I want to try to take a step back from this question of isotropization and thermalization to the point where I think of it more like an experimentalist and ask, well, really, what do we know experimentally about the isotropization and thermalization time of a quark gluon plasma, and how might we pin that down better? So, as I showed you in last week's talk about plasma instabilities, you can break down the time evolution of a heavy ion collision into these, you know, approximately five different regions. And today we're going to focus on this time interval between 0.1, which is the formation time before you can even say that there are quarks and gluons in your plasma, and some number on the order of 2 Fermi over C, which is yet to be determined, when we can say that we enter this yellow region and we have an equilibrium quark gluon plasma, which could be described, well, equilibrium isotropic quark gluon plasma, which might be described by hydro. And the question is really, how do you determine this time scale when you enter into the yellow region? Now, traditionally, the way that this is done is to make some hydro models. And the big observable that people like to throw around is what's called the elliptic flow. So if you take two nuclei and you slam them together at a finite impact parameter in the plane of the collision, you actually generate some little wedge of matter which pushes out more in the transverse direction, in this direction, in the short side of the ellipse, than in the long side of the ellipse. And this differential pushing is essentially this coefficient V2. And the statement goes around that, hydro describes this very well for PT less than 1 to 2 JeV. Above that, it stops working so well. And this is a whole debate about what's the appropriate scale for hydro to work. And this has been taken as evidence for early isotropization and possibly thermalization of the QGP. The problem is if you ever talk to somebody who actually runs one of these hydro codes, there's lots of little knobs to turn. And in the end, what you get for V2 depends first primarily on the initial conditions you choose. So you can choose, in our field, what's called Glauber initial conditions or something that's more CGC-like. You get different answers for what V2 is. And you would get different answers for what, for instance, eta over S is. In addition to this sensitivity to initial conditions, which this...
Yes, you get different answers, but, well, maybe this one Fermi shifts to 2 Fermi, but not much else happens.
Right. Well, so the uncertainties are on the order of this 1 Fermi over C number.
You don't say it completely changed.
No, I mean, you won't get 10 Fermi over C out of it. The slosh is in this area between 0.5 and 2, maybe 3. The other thing that complicates it is that V2 and what you get out of it for your final theory versus data curve depends sensitively on what happens here in this late time phase. Exactly how do you hadronize the matter? They use a very crude prescription, which is called Cooper-Frye now, which essentially you just match energy densities at some place where the temperature is gone below some what they call freeze-out temperature, and then they just convert that into thermal nuclear matter. You know, from a microscopic perspective, this is not exactly satisfying. You would like to have some hadronization procedure which produce maybe some high resonances. They interact with one another, decay down, and they produce a thermal hadron gas. And there are many people in the world that work on these things, and these hadro in Japan, in Frankfurt, you name it, all over the place. There's all these kinds of hadronic cascade models. And this phase puts another uncertainty into everything. Exactly what is the viscosity in this late time phase also affects.
Recently, his statements about hydrodynamics, they always average over the hadronic phase and the gluonic phase. And actually, the hadronic phase has a much larger viscosity. Yeah. So that we're so close to ideal hydro, there's almost no way around this, right? Because anything you do with this hadronic phase, you just increase it.
Right. Anything you do with the height, because I don't have this curve to show, but I don't know if you've seen it, you know, so eta over S versus temperature, there's typically a minimum. And if you go down in temperature to the hadronic phase, eta over S starts going back up, and if you go to the high temperature limit, it goes back up in the plasma phase. To be sitting at that minimum, you have to basically create a quark-gluon plasma, maybe strongly coupled quark-gluon plasma, that would live forever. So this quantity, eta over S, is changing as a function of time, and it changes as you go in here, and it becomes large.
This phase V2 is pretty much established. You cannot change it.
Well,
because the matter, which says, anisotropies are extend over such large distances that you cannot pull it back with viscosity. Viscosity can affect the radial direction, but then it's extremely ineffective in this kind of subsimilar expansion.
I'm quite worried at determination of let's say isotropization time depends very strongly on the hadronic phase. That is what he was saying.
It does. I mean, the question comes down to the debate which we had last week, which you say this phase doesn't exist, right? And that you just jump straight from here to freeze out. There's lots of people in the world that don't believe that, and they write big codes, I mean, to do this, and it introduces uncertainties. Now, whether or not these uncertainties are well founded, and whether these people are doing the right thing, that's a different question.
According to all of that, it shifts you from 1 to 2 Fermi at the beginning where you think you have isotropization. So that's the order of.
It shifts you from one to two Fermi if you omit this phase, or if you,
I'll come to that in a second. So.
Okay. I think this hadronization affects how V2 depends on QT. How V2 depends on momentum, because how do you combine the momentum from pre-hadronic world?
No. I mean, since we all are struggling, you know, to get this very short time, if this short time really is dependent very strongly on this hadronic phase, I start worrying a bit.
I think
it's not strongly dependent, but it's dependent. And only thing I want to tell you today is not that this is a bad way to do it, just that you might want to have another way to check to see that this is actually consistent with other observables. Yeah.
What you're saying is that the ratio time might not be.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you should just assume that it's some number in there. I mean, even if you think ADS CFT, right? Everything scales with what? The temperature of the black hole. The temperature of the black hole is 200 MeV. It's T. That's 1 Fermi/C. Every natural time scale that you get out seems to be pointing at 1 Fermi/C.
If you take versus public things like Paul Marshall, who just did a talk scene on that, he writes also in the puzzle of some kinds, 1 Fermi/C.
Okay.
That's not for the hard modes. I mean, the hard modes, when C Fermi is sufficient, you can do a lot of things with the hard modes, just with scattering. This is why these numbers really matter.
Yes. I mean, if it really is 2 to 3 Fermi/C, then the bottom-up thermalization calculation was sufficient.
So
we could have quit then. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it really does make a big difference, as we just discussed, whether it's 0.5 or 3. So you just want to find another way where you might hope to pin down some information about that number, which I call tau iso. Now, I remind you here the catch to 22 of thermalization. If you actually achieve complete thermalization and maintain it, all subsequent emissions are independent of the initial conditions. This, because you just wiped out all information about the initial conditions. So you have to go and look for observables which are sensitive to the time before it became thermalized. Now that's difficult. Now here's this V2 curve that Paul shows. I just took it. Here's the URL which you can find. It's on the web server here. And the best fit here is this this eta over S is equal to 0. The free line, which goes through the data all the way up to around 2 JeV, and then it starts diverging from the data. And then here's what he showed also. It's available here on this URL on the web server. And these three colored curves here, this is the ideal hydro result. This is some large eta over S of 0.16. Well, not so large, but large in modern day terminology. And then here is some this eta over some other small eta over S, but now varying this T0, which is the time that he turns on his hydro code, from 0.5 up to 2 Fermi over C. Now, what has he changed in this, you have to ask, and what he's changed is the freeze-out temperature by a small amount. Not enough to throw off the things like fitting spectra, things like that. He still fits spectra for pions, protons, antiprotons, all these guys. But the freeze-out temperature has been changed slightly. And as you can see, in the region where you really expect it to work, down here, there's no difference. And you only start to get resolution to that initial time at these very large PTs, which, you know, hydro doesn't work. So, yeah. So this is the second order, the viscous hydrodynamics, so including not bulk viscosity, just shear viscosity in this Israel Stewart formalism. And basically, he takes those, uses the lattice equation of state, and then puts in some initial condition for the field zero. Assuming thermalization at this time, and isotropization, yeah? So it has to be isotropic and thermal at, you know, some time like this.
What is assumed about the ratio between freeze-out temperature and phase transition temperature?
It's changing between these. But in principle, you can extend your hydro calculation into the...
If the freeze-out temperature more or less fixed, within the observed data, and still change the...
Well, I'm telling you that, he does this, and he varies the freeze-out temperature. He's still fitting the spectra.
Yeah.
He's not screwing up that part of it.
If I'm asking, keep the freeze-out temperature fixed, and vary the critical temperature.
Well, that he doesn't have that luxury, right? Because he just takes the lattice equation of state; it's fixed.
But that's more or less the same as the freeze-out temperature.
No, the freeze-out temperature you can run into with these hydro codes. In principle, they run below TC. They basically run it until you would say kinetic freeze out, because he just matches directly to
kinetic freeze out. That's definitely much lower. That's
yes.
There is no doubt about
yeah.
that.
I mean, he runs it and then just immediately converts to a thermal hadron gas. So there's he doesn't have this intermediate hadron cascade. There are some effects from resonance decays, which he has to include in order to even get the pi spectrum right and things like that. Okay. Yeah.
Is the initial condition also changed for this freeze?
No, the initial condition is exactly the same. The only thing that was changed was the freeze-out temperature. And it was just adjusted so that you fit the spectra. Well, actually, he did, no, sorry, he evolved these in some way, which I don't know exactly how he did it. It maybe free streaming expansion or something like this, up so that the initial conditions aren't fixed. I mean, it's fixed at actually QS inverse, and then you have some slosh in what happens.
This is a comment to Igor, who said when one does self-calculation, it's also useful to
go to some points where it actually breaks.
So go to five fermions. Or you have. No, but these are various viscosities. But
right.
there's some insensitivity to the initial times, right?
Yes.
For between half and two, it would be useful to know whether one can do four.
Right. Yes, it's an interesting question. So I'm not trying to say that this is all crap. All I'm saying is that there's lots of knobs, and you want to find another way. So what I want to talk to you about now is to use electromagnetic observables to try to constrain the initial conditions. Now, this is an old idea. It goes back to the early 80s, but mainly when, mid-80s. And what people were mostly concerned about then was fixing the initial temperature. They would assume that you made a thermalized plasma already at the formation time, and they were just trying to fix the temperature at the formation time. We want to try to extend that a little bit and tack on some period in which the plasma may be non-equilibrium and see how sensitive we are to that non-equilibrium phase. So I think I've already made the first two points. Now, why are the electromagnetic observables the ideal candidates for this? Well, they just couple electromagnetically. There's no strong coupling. In the next leading order corrections, you start getting strong couplings, but at least in the strong coupling constant running around in your expressions, but at least from the calculations which have been done of photon and dileptron production, the next leading order, these are small corrections. You can't say this a priori. You just have to sit down and do the calculation, and you find out that the leading order E and M photon and dileptron rates are pretty damn good, up to a factor of 2, not a factor of 10 or 100. Yeah. Now, today I'm going to be talking about dileptrons, and in the conference I'll also add on some information about the photons. The photons are difficult because, I don't know if you know experimentally, but there's a big background from pi zero decay. So pi zero goes to gamma gamma. And this is the actually most abundant source of high energy photons. And this has to be subtracted out by the experimentalists to even see a medium signal. The dileptrons, however, they have a couple of different parameters which you can study them as a function of both the invariant mass, so p squared or e squared, if you like, p squared, the four momentum squared, which is essentially the photon virtuality on this line here, and then also the transverse momentum of the pair. Now, I'll come to why that's important when I show you the results. Well, actually, I'll say it now. Sorry. Well, this is important because these backgrounds, at leading order Drell-Yan, just coming from hard scattering from the nucleonic wave functions, is peaked at PT is equal to 0. You can't generate any transverse momentum from that, from leading order Drell-Yan from the nucleonic wave functions. So you have to go to next to leading order in order to even generate any finite PT for your dileptron pairs. So that, in essence, suppresses this Drell-Yan background as a function of PT to some higher order, so you have some hope. So I show that in a few slides. So what do we do in practice? So this dileptron rate, so this is the number of dileptrons per D4P. It depends on the plasma anisotropy, so if the plasma has particles flying up and down this way, or if it's isotropic. And then it depends on the angle of this dileptron pair with respect to the beam axis. In an isotropic plasma, you'd get completely isotropic emission. If there's an anisotropy in the plasma, it tends to prefer emission along the direction that the partons are flying. The reason that this is, it's easiest to think about photons. Imagine that you had a gas of quarks, which were just flying up and down in a sheet, and they were slamming into each other. The photons that are produced are mostly collinear. This is true at leading order, and it's also true at next to leading order. And because they're mostly collinear, that means they're going to mostly come out aligned with this plane of partons that you have. And there's not going to be a lot of them flying out this way. So to leading order, we just have to compute this very simple graph in the case of dileptrons. With photons, it's more complicated, and I'll talk about that in a couple of weeks. So you just have to put some distribution function, fq, fq bar here, and make it anisotropic in momentum space by introducing my little Cassie parameter. If Cassie is greater than zero, this corresponds to a squish of the distribution. If Cassie is less than zero, it's a stretch. And you can relate this Cassie parameter directly to the average transverse momentum and the longitudinal momentum in the plasma. To show you the sort of rate results, this is actually for photons, not dileptons. I couldn't find the equivalent plot for the dileptons. This shows the rate for photon production scaled by the hard momentum scale, so the average momentum in your anisotropic plasma here, this little yellow blob, as a function of for three different angles. Theta q is equal to pi over 2, which corresponds to photons which would come flying out this way along the transverse to the beam axis. N hat here is the beam axis where the guys are flying along. This is for a fixed distribution, just to show you the effect on the rate. Now we have to fold that over spacetime. That comes next. So for a fixed distribution, you can compute the rate, you do this, and then you vary the angle, and you see that these guys, which are that would be flying out this way, right along the beam line, are highly suppressed, especially at high energies. If you look at 6 JeV, that's 8 versus 4. You have a 4 order of magnitude suppression. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to get a 4 order of magnitude suppression in some experimental signal. But to compute the final experimental signal, you have to fold over spacetime. So I showed you this cartoon last week of the average longitudinal momentum in our plasma scaled by the average transverse momentum in the plasma. And at early times, you can't even talk about partons. You have to do this CGC and plasma stuff up until about the formation time of the partons. And then after that formation time, maybe even a little bit before, the system is expanding, so the longitudinal momentum are being depleted. The longitudinal momentum, if this was truly a free streaming gas that was just flying away in one direction, would go like 1 over the proper time, and the transverse momentum would stay approximately fixed. Now, we hope that at some point this is all stopped, this free streaming one-dimensional expansion of your plasma, by interactions in the plasma, which then turn this around and take it back to something that looks more isotropic. So you can then introduce a couple of time scales. One is this formation time, T0, and then another time scale which I call tau iso. So this is the time at which I say that the thing is approximately isotropic, and you can use, it's safe to use hydro. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you have to assume that they basically, that the quarks themselves are free streaming away. There are quarks there in the initial state. Most people say in the high energy limit that it's gluon dominated, but there are quarks. Well, in this initial time, it's going to be free streaming. And then at some late time, I then say, I don't know what happens, and I'm going to parameterize my ignorance. So the basic model then comes down to trying to determine, the basic question comes down to trying to determine this tau iso. Now you can turn this plot that I've made of PL over PT into a statement about this Cassie parameter. And what I show you is here what Cassie would look like if it were free streaming up to some point and then just rapidly turned around and went back to isotropic. And I show that for three different isotropization times. T0 here is 0.1 Fermi over C. So this is 1 Fermi over C, 2 Fermi over C. And as you can see, if it was really truly free streaming, this Cassie parameter increases very rapidly. And then if you wanted it to turn around, it needs to drop back to zero rather abruptly. So now you want to take this kind of idea and turn it into a model for the energy density evolution, the anisotropy evolution, and the temperature evolution of your plasma.
So So who produced that plasma in here, this curve which goes down the old one?
Yeah.
Who produced that figure?
This?
Yes.
Me.
And so you're the only one who made some arguments why it should be valid.
No, I mean, if you go to bottom-up thermalization, so Mueller, Son, Schiff, those guys, this is actually, this ratio is zero in the beginning of their paper, because they just let it free stream, and it's essentially a two-dimensional gas in there. And this is what you expect in the ultra-high energy limit. Now, it's true, and I haven't even put a number here, notice, about how anisotropic it becomes, because I don't know. Yeah? I don't know. You could put whatever scale you like, and that's the question that we're trying to determine, is exactly how anisotropic does it become, and then how quickly does it go back.
So this is a theoretical...
Yes, this is the theoretical curve. Nobody knows in reality how this goes.
And then different pieces will come from different approximations.
Yes.
But will the psi not depend also on how anisotropic it becomes?
Well, C is the anisotropy parameter. It's just pt squared over 2pl squared. It will depend on assumptions, and I.
And only on T over T0, but also on other assumptions.
In the ultra high energy limit, it really would be free streaming for some time, and then it would turn around. Now, how it turns around and all that, it's an unsolved problem currently, actually.
I mean, how did you ask it from the, how did you normalize this curve on the right?
This curve on the right.
Yeah.
I've normalized this by just assuming that it was free streaming, and I'll show you in just a second. I just normalized it that it's free streaming up until one Fermi over C, and then it very rapidly makes a transition to hydro. So what is the very simple model that we want to create here? We have two different possibilities. We start at some formation time. I'm going to concentrate on LHC, so this number is something on the order of 0.1 Fermi over C. And we specify some given energy density of the matter that we've created at this time. And now we have two different possibilities in this model. One is that the thing immediately, instantly thermalizes, and then it just starts doing ideal hydro. If this was just one-dimensional expansion, ignoring transverse expansion effects of viscosity and such, this would drop like 1 on tau to the 4/3. This is what most people that calculate electromagnetic observables from a QGP do. They assume, just from the beginning, that it's instantly thermal. Now, there's another possibility, which is this free streaming, where this curve initially doesn't go like 1 on tau to the 4/3, but it drops like 1 on tau for some time. And then after some time, it makes a transition from this slope here on a log-log plot to the next slope, which is the ideal hydro curve. And you just want to match the energy densities here at tau iso between your free streaming gas and your now ideal hydro expanding gas. The black line here is if you assume there's a theta function transition between free streaming and hydro, but then there's another parameter which we introduce, which we call gamma, which basically just sets the width of this transition. We just take a theta function and we smear it out. And that, for a typical gamma, would give you this little brown curve here that connects the two. So now you can turn that into a real mathematical model which you can write down. I don't want you to stare at the bottom of the equations too much. The important things are here. So for a free streaming plasma, if you really had PL dropping like 1 over tau and PT, the average transverse momentum, approximately fixed, it's a very simple algebra to plug that in, and you find that if that were true, this Cassie parameter would increase quadratically with the proper time.
What can you do if you don't just have free streaming or hydro?
I show. I just parameterize it. I don't know what else to do better right now, but I'll show you what comes out. In this free streaming plasma phase, if you go to some time greater than T0, the energy density scales like 1 over the proper time. And the temperature, which you can't really call a temperature because the thing's not thermal or isotropic, is basically some fixed scale, and it's just the average transverse momentum of the partons in this free streaming gas. On the opposite side, we have this isotropic plasma, and here I'm just going to assume that viscosities are really zero, and that corresponds to the assumption here that this C parameter is identically zero.
This time dependence
is from expansion, yes. And here it's expansion plus interactions, essentially, which would bring it. Yeah? Yeah, it's just the volume.
But they also slow down once you're looking at the free streaming part. So that gets also that, and they lose energy in the way it slows down. Yeah, but they are coming in from the neighborhood. And they come. They are part of the Sakori. How long do you need?
It's confusing when you try to think in lab frame about this. You can go and calculate the energy density rather as a function of tau in co-moving coordinates, so in Bjorken tau eta coordinates, and you would calculate t tau tau in that case. At early times, it's some more complicated function than this, but for tau greater than t zero, it becomes this. Yes. So we include that exactly. It's only in this limit that it really becomes one on tau.
How it corresponds to your previous slide.
Yeah.
How does it correspond? Yeah.
So this, if it was really true free streaming forever, you would start with some energy density, and the energy density would drop like one on tau, and it would just keep going forever down like that. If it was ideal hydro, it drops as 1 on tau to the 4/3, and you get a completely different time evolution of the energy density in your plasma.
And how do you understand this 4/3 factor? Is just the pressure? It's isotropic expansion, or just?
It's isotropic expansion. Yeah. I mean, well, the original papers which got this 4/3 go back to Bjorken hydrodynamics, and you can just.
So the pressure doesn't work.
Yes. There are also people who calculate this coefficient now in ADS CFT without any in principle assumptions. I don't want to get into that. Any more questions on this? So now what we want to do is just create some model which interpolates between these two with some variable time scale, which we call tau iso or tau hydro. Sometimes you'll see it written as tau hydro. And then we're just going to put some smeared step function when tau is less than this tau hydro, in this case is 5, then I'm in the free streaming phase, and if I'm above, then I'm in the hydro phase. Yeah, just a model, fitting in a model. So you can then, once you construct this model, which I wrote there in a very unintuitive way, it's better to look at these pictures. Here is this, first let's look at this energy density. Here is the energy density in JeV to the 4 for an LHC collision. And you start out, if you were to have in the model perfectly ideal hydro expansion, it would be this black curve. If you had had tau iso was 0.2 Fermi over C, it's this red curve. 0.8 Fermi over C, it's this one, and 2 Fermi over C, it's this one. And you can make analogous plots for how this C parameter varies as you change the assumed tau iso and also the temperature. So the temperature before you actually hit this hydrophase, you can't really say it's a temperature. It's just some average momentum scale in this plasma. If you were really truly free streaming, it would be fixed, 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 and then we make a transition very rapidly to the hydrophase. You can relax this assumption. That was for this gamma parameter is around 2. So you have a very rapid transition here. Be careful that this is a log-log plot, so the transition's not getting more and more rapid. It looks very rapid here, but it's actually over a sizable chunk of tau zeros. So you can also vary this parameter gamma, and in that case, you don't see any of these kinks. You see rather instead some curve that's not really constant. It's dropping, but not like it would drop in hydro. But then at some late time, here is 5 Fermi over C. So these are, again, varying tau iso. And in the case that gamma is 0.05, you don't generate quite as large anisotropies. You only go up to 17.5 in this case, or 17, whereas before we went up to like 200. So varying this parameter gamma sort of softens this whole transition. So this is just a model. But now you need to take that model, this space-time model, and essentially you need these two curves. You need to know what is this, the average momentum scale of the partons in the gas, which I'm colliding together. I fold that together with the rate for their production, and then I integrate over space-time. And I turn it off at some temperature down here when one of these curves hits my deconfining phase transition. What that deconfining phase transition temperature is, as I'll show you in the very end, doesn't really matter so much because this observable is primarily, if you look at high energy dileptons, is primarily sensitive to this region, which you're trying to study. So you can vary the deconfinement temperature all over the place. So what comes out? So here I show you a plot for LHC. Now the reason I don't show you for RIC is because the data just doesn't exist for RIC. The maximum invariant masses which they go up to are around the 3 JeVs. All of the focus in the electromagnetic observable community at RIC has been below 3 JeV, unfortunately. That's bad because really your leverage and sensitivity to these initial conditions lies above that. If you go below 3 JeV, you're sensitive to late times, transverse expansion, what happens in the hadronic phase, all of these possible resonance productions. It becomes a god-awful mess. So what you want to do, in principle, is go to these higher energy guys, in this case, mass somewhere between the J psi and the upsilon, and then try to fix things there. And what I show you here is on a log plot, the rate of dielectron production per unit rapidity and per unit invariant mass scale. And I've cut it so that I only take dileptons with PT greater than 8 JeV. Now, the only reason I've taken that particular cut is because I needed to compare to past calculations in which they took that cut. We can cut the result on any momentum we like. The initial temperature is something like 845 MeV. This is my 0.1 formation time. And then this is my deconfinement phase transition temperature. I think actually it's 170 in the code. That's a typo. And then I show you the different contributions. The big background, starting from the top, are heavy quark decays. A lot of this can be subtracted out because it's not really correlated pairs. I mean, these come from, say, a D0 decaying with two of its quarks and then producing dileptons from each, producing one lepton essentially from each of its quark lines. It looks like a dilepton event, but you can subtract a lot of those off. It's not exactly great because this is, an order of magnitude subtraction you have to do. Then there's the other contributions. Drell-Yan, this is just coming from when you slam the parton distribution functions together and you just compute the rate for dilepton production from there. That gives this red curve. Then there's something that's called jet conversion. This comes from the fact that you can have jets which have a power law distribution in the plasma. interacting with something that has a thermal distribution. That, at least that's the way it's traditionally calculated. And so you can then calculate the rate for these jets slamming off a thermal distribution and how many photons they would produce. A lot of this is subtractable because those photons that will be produced will be very focused around the jets. So there's some hope that you might be able to subtract that off. And then I show you two different possible curves. One is if you assume tau hydro is 0.1 Fermi over C, specifically 0.08 Fermi over C, and that's this green line down here. And then I show you the same thing, but now varying tau hydro up to 2 Fermi over C, and that gives you this black curve that's going through there. Now, the good news is that here there's an order of magnitude variation in the signal as you vary this parameter around.
Yeah.
If you go below 2,
there wouldn't be a big difference.
No, there would be a big difference still, but then it starts to introduce other model parameters which you have to introduce. You have to then worry about the transverse expansion of the matter. You then have to worry about what are the viscous effects and all this stuff. The late time.
The curves seem to move away from each other.
Mm.
It just tells me that we don't even know what's happening
there. I can show you how it extrapolates down. I don't have that curve here with me, but I can calculate it, but I wouldn't trust it because those kind of things really become dominated by this late time, the late time emissions. Yeah. Well, it's this time-dependent function which I showed you. In this case, it's this. I chose gamma is equal to 2 for this plot. And I'll show you what happens when you start varying this gamma parameter. So C is actually time-dependent. It goes up, and then it goes down and goes back to 0. Yeah, so that's why we specifically focus on these high-energy dileptons, because in the initial state of the plasma, it's the hottest, it has the highest energy densities, and that's when you really do produce the highest energy dileptons. As the thing cools down, you don't produce any more high-energy dileptons like this. They all get pushed to lower and lower energies. So if you really want to learn something about 1-2 Fermi over C, you got to go to these guys. No, the energy density is exactly the same. In the final energy densities are the same. Actually, the final time changes because in this, these would be the two curves you would want to compare, essentially. It's not because of this. The reason that it's really stays up is because the fact that this temperature stays higher.
Yeah.
You preserve more transverse momentum.
But when you enter the high curve,
It's not the thing that's giving you the enhancement. I have a backup slide to try to prove that to you. So here I show, for the same curve that I showed, as a function of PT with the same cut, same critical temperature, everything is the same, but I just show you the produced fraction. So this black line is the number of dileptons you would have gotten at the number of dileptons that you get up to 1 Fermi over C, scaled by the total number that you got out. Does that definition make sense to you? If I go all the way to the end of the collision, this is 1 by definition. I've gotten all of the dileptons out that I'm ever going to get out. Now I can see how much in this energy range have these dileptons, what percentage of these dileptons have been produced by 1 Fermi over C, 2 Fermi over C, and 4 Fermi over C. And what you see is that here,
let's just look
at the 4GeV point, at 1 Fermi over C, you've produced 93% of these guys. At 2 Fermi over C, you've produced 97%. So anything, any correction to the model or anything that happens after that time is only a 3-4% correction. But yes, it's the higher energy density in the end. Yeah.
So for epitope zero, you always produce dielectrons. You always produce dielectrons at any stage of an evolution.
Yes.
So when you change tau zero, you basically change the amounts which get produced in equilibrated phase and in early phase.
Yes.
So if tau zero is late, then you get more early ones, and they are from very hot.
Yes. Exactly. If I would vary tau zero on this plot, tau zero I don't vary, it's tau iso. On this plot, I think tau iso was 0.5 Fermi over C. So it was very early in this case. And you can, if you change it to later, you get approximately the same curves.
So what happens if you keep the profile for K
You could play that game as well. I mean, we don't have that as a separate dialable parameter. Essentially, we have this gamma parameter, but it does two things. It lowers the maximum anisotropy parameter, but it also spreads out the transition. So you could come up with another simple model which just had some maximum Cassie and then it dropped to zero in some way. But make the peak.
You had 200 and down to 17, and all you did was smooth out this corner a little bit.
Right. It's just from this model. It's a model. Now, you just put in here, if this lambda is zero, this A is tau over tau zero. Here it's written. If this lambda is zero, then it grows quadratically. If this lambda is one, then it goes to zero. And so you just put in this smeared function. It's not physical at all. And I don't have any physics argument for why that should be. It's a model. If I keep decreasing gamma, yeah, you could turn C into 2. But then you would have a situation where it wouldn't ever look like hydro at all. This is already at 0.5. And I would say that here it only really starts looking like hydro at something around 4 Fermi over C. And as you take gamma smaller and smaller, at least within this model, you sort of push that effective tau iso higher and higher. You sort of stay in this kind of place between free streaming and hydro expansion longer.
Yeah, I'm just confused about it. How do I know what if I'm varying gamma or if I'm varying zero?
The primary effect comes from varying tau iso,
and
you should think about it, and it's a model parameter which you should, in principle, if you were a physicist fitting data, you fit simultaneously tau iso and gamma, hopefully on multiple observables, maybe photons and dielectrons simultaneously, and then also making different cuts on the data and comparing theoretical predictions based on those cuts with experimental observations. Here I show what happens if you choose tau iso is equal to 0.5 Fermi over C versus what happens if you choose tau iso is 2 Fermi over C. This is now as a function of PT instead of a variant mass. I haven't gotten to the result for that yet, but I'll show it to you in a second. And these bars here are the variation which you observe in the predicted final yields when you vary this gamma parameter from this very soft transition of 0.05 to basically a theta function, step transition. And as you can see, there's a window here between, say, 3 and 6 where these curves aren't touching at all. So you would have some hope that you would be able to resolve the difference between 0.5 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's here. Yeah. So this is already the bottom end of that temperature profile, the variation.
Suppose you would have another where start is just constant, but you would have this temperature for more variation. I guess you would be similar differences.
I don't think so. I mean, the reason that...
I'm just asking you.
Yeah.
I have the impression that the temperature makes everything different. When you have this...
But you can't make a finite C plasma consistent with ideal hydro expansion. And you also can't, so you have to go back to zero at some point. And then. Yeah, as I said, yeah, it is the fact that this temperature doesn't
drop as fast,
and it's that the energy density doesn't drop as fast. That is the primary effect. But in order to fold it all together, you have to specify this as well. Now, this actually makes a big difference, which I don't show you, unfortunately, in these slides, for the rapidity dependence. All of the plots that I've shown you so far for y is equal to zero, what this Cassie parameter is actually does matter very much for the rapidity dependence of the... Yes, as I showed you first. Yeah. So I return here after trying to, you know, somehow justify this very simple model. I admit it is simple, but maybe it captures the essential details. And here was this variation if you plot as a function of invariant mass. Now, this is bad news. Although it varies by an order of magnitude, even if you assumed that it was at 2 Fermi over C, it's on the same order of magnitude as these other production mechanisms, Drellian and jet conversion. So even if you were lucky enough to subtract off this heavy quark stuff, you would then have to disentangle these three contributions. And I don't want to have to do that. I think it would be bad. So the benefit that you get from the dileptons is that you can also study them as a function of transverse momentum of the dilepton pair. And here again, I showed on a log scale the rate dy, this should be dpt squared, sorry. And then some cut in the invariant mass again. This cut is just to compare to, I've chosen it here just to compare to other people's papers where they applied similar cuts. Your sensitivity to these early time stuff increases as you make the cuts higher and higher. But this is a double-edged sword because as you make the cuts higher and higher, statistics get lower and lower, and uncertainties increase. So you have to do multiple cuts, I would say. All right, so now we can compare the different production mechanisms, as I showed you, as a function of invariant mass, but now as a function of PT. The Drell-Yan here is this black curve. Boop, 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 boop. As I said, you have to go to next to leading order to even get any PT finite support here for the Drell-Yan. That's why it's a little bit lower. You can calculate this jet conversion. Unfortunately, the jet conversion guys only went down to 8 JeV in their paper, so that's the last point I was able to steal. And then you can do the same game. Instant thermalization and hydro is the blue, and 2 Fermi over C is the green. This is really good news. And what we're trying to do is go around and convince experimentalists, at least at LHC, that they should really measure the PT dependence of the dileptons in this range. If you naively extrapolate this jet guy down, here below 6 JeV, even if you assumed an isotropic plasma, the medium contribution is dominating both the Drell-Yan and this jet conversion. Now, if you assume tau hydro or tau iso is 2 Fermi over C, this thing is already dominating out at 10 JeV. So you have this window somewhere between 2 and, let's say conservatively, 6 JeV, where the medium dilepton production is the dominant production mechanism. And you have a lever now which you can use to determine some information about that early plasma phase. Yeah. because I could not find the data for this, it runs here, at least in conversations I've had with experimentalists. But nobody has, as far as I could find, published the PT dependence of the heavy quark bag.
Can you find that?
Yes. Yeah, that then it becomes a delicate question of how well can you subtract the heavy quark stuff. Now your ability to do this increases as you go to LHC. Some of those background heavy quark productions come from some really high energy charm quark stuff, like an upsilon. It decays down with one electron coming off and a neutrino to a d, which then decays down and it gives you what looks like a two e plus and an e minus. But these are not real pairs, and what they have at LHC now is really very good vertex resolution, down to about 10 microns. And if you estimate the time scale for these weak decays, it's on the order of 100 microns. So you can actually resolve these kind of vertices. So there is hope to subtract off that heavy quark stuff. I'm not going to say it's simple. Intuitively, no, I don't. I just do the calculation. Yeah. I mean, they do have a different slope. It's not just a shift up and down, yeah. I mean, you can kind of think of it, I guess, is that, you know, if the temperature stays higher for longer, that causes this to be a flatter curve, yeah. That's the easy way to think about it, I guess, intuitively. So out here, it really looks like you had just a different effective temperature. Up here, you become sensitive to this region where it's making the transition between the free streaming and the hydro expansion. All right, seems I'm perfectly on time. So I just tried to motivate people as theorists to think about this question of what are some observables, and I tried to show you at least one, which are sensitive to this initial 1 to 2 Fermi over C of the plasma lifetime. The goal, of course, I think is obvious, that we as physicists have to constrain ourselves by data, and the more data we have to constrain us, the better. We now have simple models which will allow us to calculate the effect of these anisotropies. Now, if in the future you guys were to exactly solve, or you know, maybe I get lucky, solve the thermalization isotropization problem exactly, then you can just throw my model out the back door and replace it by your exact time-dependent model of Cassie and the temperature and these things, and then calculate and see if it's consistent with the data. And in the final plot, I just tried to show you that there's some kind of window here, I say between 3 and 7 GeV in the PT dependence of these dilepton productions, where it's the dominant medium contribution. And so if you can subtract off the backgrounds from the heavy quark decays, which is, again, not so easy, but may be doable, then you'll have some window into the medium. So what's left to do? Well, currently we're calculating the next to leading order rate. This involves some big computers doing Monte Carlo calculations. Inclusion of possible chemical non-equilibrium, which I haven't discussed today. The effect will remain, because to leading order, the dilepton rate comes out to just be proportional to the quark fugacity. And if you were to do this for an anisotropic or an isotropic one, they'll both be proportional to this quark fugacity. So if you take the ratio, it cancels out. So the effect, the variation will remain, but it might shift these curves up and down. So you have to worry about that as well. And then the last thing, which maybe somebody here would like to undertake, is to actually recalculate these jet conversion signals, because the existing jet medium production curves come from an assumption of instantaneous thermalization and isotropization. And if that's not true, then even this jet conversion stuff is going to get modified. And probably there's also a sensitivity to this Cassie and tau iso also in the jet medium production. And it may even give you a better signal than the one that we're talking about now. All right, thanks. Yeah. Yes. Well, that's primarily what I'm interested in, is the isotropization timescale for the hard guys, because they're the ones that take the longest.
Right. The one for hydrogen.
That's true. But if you're a strict, you know, adherent of everything should be isotropized on all scales before you believe hydro, then this is the way you would determine it. Now, I agree that for the low-end guys, you could basically have a tau iso that depends on momentum scale. You could build that into the model.
Yeah, I think I wanted to point out that it's not very, it might not be exactly what...
Right. I would say, yeah, in some sense, it's the worst case number because it's coming from the hard guys. Yeah. But they're the guys that are dominating. They dominate the energy density, they dominate this process, so it's exactly where you want to look, I think. Yeah, they're exactly.
There's always a good strategy to say you have to wait for the next machine. is there, in your opinion, you say there's no idea, no chance, something that you could think of doing for existing data?
Well, for existing data, I don't have it here. It's in the paper which is coming out. We do the same calculations for RIC. And you see, again, an order of magnitude variation. The problem is that the only point I can find and get from Barbara Jacek of the Phoenix collaboration is right here at 3. One point. And that's all I have. It's hard to really do anything with one point, with a big error bar even. Yeah, so we have Barbara coming at the end of the month, and I'm going to try to squeeze the data out of her. Because I requested multiple times, and it only goes up to 3 JeV at RIC, and then there's just one point sitting there, and that's all you have. I mean, I could fit it from that, but I think fitting from one point is ill-advised. Right. So that brings in another, because you have to correlate this now with your hydro simulation as well. So here I've chosen a particular T0. You might also vary T0 around. And then so what you would do is try to find the best fit. You have different parameters. You have T0, you have tau iso, and you have this gamma thing. At first you might want to just say gamma is infinity for simplicity, and then just fit T0 and tau iso. Then you would have to take those, send them back to the guy that's doing the hydro calculation, have him plug them in, and see if it's consistent with his stuff. I don't know how else to do it. I mean, in principle, though, this number is given by CGC initial conditions. In principle. So in principle, this number is fixed. But in practice, you always want to vary it around and see how sensitive you are to it. It's the same for tau zero. I mean, it's, you know, from the CGC language, this is some number on the order of QS inverse, but people don't even know what QS inverse is exactly. So there's parameters everywhere, and it's not perfect, but it's a different, complementary in some sense to the other way of doing it. And they would have to be constrained by the same parameters, the hydro guys. It's not like we have a different set of parameters and they have a different set of parameters. It's the same set of parameters, except for gamma, which they don't have. But all right, thanks.